Professor Joyce Malcolm is professor of legal history at George Mason University School of Law. She has a PhD in comparative history from Brandeis University. Her work was cited several times in D.C. versus Heller. Among her books are Guns and Violence, The English Experience, 2002, and To Keep and Bear Arms, The Origins of an Anglo-American Right, 1994. After the London riots in 2011, Professor Malcolm had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, The Soft on Crime Roots of British Disorder, and you will find that at tab four. Professor Malcolm is frequently interviewed about criminal law and self-defense for radio programs in Britain, Canada, and the USA. Her topic this morning is Common Law Tradition of Self-Defense, the Divergence Between the American and British Approach in the 20th Century, and the Repercussions for Public Safety. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here. Is this joining you too?
Yes, it's working.
Can you hear it okay? Great. Just one point about Don's comment about European laws on self-defense and arms, and that is that I think you'd have to exclude the UK from, you know, more generous allowances of the right to be armed and the right to defend yourself. And that basically is the thrust of my discussion today. We start out with an Anglo-American belief and the idea that your most precious right is your right to self-defense. It's your most basic right that the law can't interfere with. But in the course of the 20th century, these two very related systems went in very different directions with real repercussions, which I think I have some statistics for, although I should say that trying to establish a counterfactual of what would have happened if this law didn't pass is extraordinarily difficult. Nonetheless, I think that it's worth trying. I do have some statistics for you. But as an example of the results of the parting of the ways of the British, we saw this summer during August these riots in England where the English people were reduced to buying baseball bats, and Amazon had this 5,000% increase in the sale of baseball bats in 1 week. They were buying baseball bats because that's about all that they were able to have to protect themselves. And in 2009, England was the most violent country in Europe. At the same time, America, which had increasing numbers of guns in 2010, had yet another large drop in violent crime, with robberies down 10%. And property crime down 8% over the previous year. So different approaches. The shared view, as I say, is that, that self-defense is your most basic right. Blackstone says self-defense is justly called the primary law of nature. So it is not, neither can it be in fact taken away by the law of society. And I'm focusing on self-defense because to me, the whole point of firearms and what makes it a constitutional right is self-defense. I don't think that hunting is a constitutional right in the same way. Self-defense is really the core of it. Blackstone says the law respects the passions of the human mind and makes it lawful in him to do himself that immediate justice to which he is prompted by nature and which no prudential motives are strong enough to restrain. It considers the future process of law by no means an adequate remedy for injuries accompanied with force. And then he divides all the rights into what he calls the three great and primary rights: personal security, personal liberty, and private property. Personal security is first. And more influential in this country was John Locke, who I'm sure most of you are familiar with. And on this subject, he says about self-defense, "For I have reason to conclude that he who would get me into his power without my consent would use me as he pleased when he got me there, and destroy me when he had a fancy to it. For nobody can desire to have me in his absolute power, unless it be to compel me by force to that which is against the right of my freedom." What I'd like to do is sort of briefly go through the U.S. Approach, and then the British approach as a comparison. I'm sure you're familiar with the U.S. approach, so I'll go through it briefly. fairly quickly and give you some statistics at the end of that. You know, the Second Amendment is what we look to for the right to have arms for self-defense. So, and although the Supreme Court didn't clarify that it was an individual right until 2008, the great majority of Americans have always believed that they had an individual right to have arms for self-defense. The first restrictions in this country came in the early 20th century. New York passed the Sullivan Act, Sullivan Law, 1911, basically afraid that all the immigrants that were flooding into the country were going to be a threat. And of course, this was the time when you have the anarchist with a bomb in his hand, very familiar. Although then it was in his hand and not strapped around his waist. But at any rate, that started the restrictions in New York State, sort of clamping down on people who have firearms. In the South, there were laws put in effect to keep blacks from being armed with the same worry about their attacking other people. So here were these sort of, up until the early 20th century, there was really not much in the way of restrictions. Then in 1934, you've got the National Firearms Act, which outlawed certain weapons that were very popular with criminals, like sawed-off shotguns and silencers, because this was the era of Al Capone, and effort to reduce the amount of liquor that people drank, and the soaring success of gangs as a result of that. But at any rate, that spurred outlawing particular weapons. Then we have the Gun Control Act of 1968. I'm looking at the federal ones that limited mail order sales purchased by felons of firearms and the import of firearms, which apparently Robert Pottrell tells me was actually encouraged importing firearms after World War II as a way of getting military weapons into the right hands, moving them into America as opposed to leaving them to others who might misuse them. And then, of course, we've got the Brady Act with its background checks in 1993. The people who argue that you don't need to have weapons because the police will protect you. So the Second Amendment is outdated. We now have a police force that's ready and able to protect you at all times. Are not only naive but kind of deceiving, because there's some legal cases which make it very clear that the police have no obligation to protect you. I mean, all of us have commonsensically know that they cannot be everywhere all the time protecting everybody, so that you have to allow people to protect themselves. And the American take on it usually is that people have a right to protect themselves. The case that I just wanted to mention today, which is directly to that issue, ironically, is a case that involves the District of Columbia, who, during the Heller discussion, made a big point of saying we can't stand by and let people be killed. But in fact, in a case called Warren versus the District of Columbia in 1981, that's exactly what happened. In that case, there were three women who shared a townhouse on Capitol Hill, and two men broke in to the house. There was one roommate who was downstairs, and the other two upstairs heard her screaming. They called 911 and repeatedly called 911 for half an hour, and nobody ever came. Apparently, later on, there was some policeman who driven by, so nothing went on his way. So when the screaming of the roommate downstairs stopped, the other two thought the police must have arrived. They went downstairs only to find that the two men were still there. For 14 hours, these two men abused these poor women, who, after this horrendous experience, sued the police in D.C. And that's what Warren versus District of Columbia was about. The Court of Appeals in D.C. found against them, saying that it's a, quote, fundamental principle of American law that a government and its agents are under no general duty to provide public services such as police protection, to any individual citizen. To me, this is the perfect example of a collective right. You have general right to be protected, but you have no individual right to be protected. And so it's only reasonable that if the government is not going to protect you and the police don't have any responsibility to protect you, you ought to be allowed to protect yourself. There are 44 states that have a right to keep and bear arms in their constitutions. And of course, most of you are aware of the movement in the states toward allowing people to carry weapons concealed. And to me, that is the sort of great story that's not really been thoroughly vetted. I think that there's a lot of attention paid to what the federal government does. But the federal government had been moving in a more restrictive direction, and even at the same time they were doing that, the states were going in the other direction and have been increasingly allowing more and more people to carry weapons concealed to stand their ground if attacked. On the concealed carry, there are 49 states that permit it. I should say, having come from one of those states, which is Massachusetts, the permission is really very iffy. I mean, it's up to the sheriff to decide at his discretion whether you need a gun or not to carry it. And there were some who actually bragged that they never gave anybody permission. So it was not only discretionary, it was really kind of arbitrary. However, of the anybody guess the one state that doesn't allow concealed carry at all?
Illinois.
Right, Illinois. Who said that?
I did.
Give him a star. Yeah, Illinois. I wouldn't have automatically thought that. But at any rate, of the 49 that do permit it, there are 39 now shall issue it, unlike Massachusetts, where under Penelope fulfill ordinary requirements and show that, you know, gun that you are, they are required to give you a weapon. And so over the course of the last 15 years, hundreds of thousands of additional people have not only been allowed to own guns, but they've been allowed to carry them concealed. I mean, it used to be that open carry was considered the way to go in the early days, and concealed carry was thought to be something that criminals used. It was, more dangerous because you couldn't. But now people feel more worried about open carry, and concealed carry seems okay. It's obviously been argued as a deterrent. We don't have any exact number of the number of guns in this country because there isn't registration. However, thanks to the Brady Act, we do know how many people apply to get a gun. And to give you a sense of how that's moving in this country, based on the FBI background checks, 2009, so that's the latest number I can get. I think there may be a new one. 2009, there were 14,033,824 people who applied for a background check to get a gun. 14 million, up 10% from the prior year. So this country is awash in guns and allowing people. Has that resulted in a great increase in crime? Well, violent crime has been going down for 20 years, some say for 30 years. It peaked in 1991 when there was something like 758 crimes per 100,000, count by 100,000 population. So 758 in 1991, 2009, it was down to 429.4 crimes, whatever 0.4 crimes. Per 100,000. So the fact that you have far more guns has not meant that violent crime goes up. Now, this isn't just homicide, obviously. It's a whole range of violent crimes. But the guns certainly haven't promoted crime, and in any event, they very likely to have helped to deter it. And in 2010, the Wall Street Journal reported, quote, U.S. logs, big drop in crime. So after the 14 million applied, and presumably most of them got guns, a permission to buy a gun. There was a big drop in crime. Robberies fell 10% in 1 year. And property crimes fell for the 8th consecutive year. So here's the American approach towards self-defense, allowing people to protect themselves, moving in favor of people, being able to have personal weapons, to actually carry the personal weapons, sort of state by state, having that argument. I testified before Congress this fall about this Reciprocity Act for being able to take concealed carry across states. And the chairman was from Wisconsin. I had included Wisconsin as one of the concealed carry states, they had just passed this law, which he said was okay for me to include it, since it was about to go into effect and the governor had signed it. So the last few years have just seen this huge move in that direction, and I think that is a story that people are not necessarily aware of, since there's so much focus on at the national issue rather than the effect. And the ironic thing about it, just mention this at the end, is that in the Heller case, in Breyer's decision and his dissent, he said that allowing people to have having an individual right and allowing them to have a gun would be very upsetting. You know, it would upset the general view of the public, the culture, as you put it. Quote, totally ignoring the fact that the great majority of Americans were in favor of this, believed in it, and that more and more states were, in fact, permitting people to have guns and carry them. Okay, the British example, which maybe probably is less known to you, they started from the same premise that there was an individual right to protect oneself, self-defense, which are most basic rights. But then they decided that really in a modern society, society will protect you. You don't need to do it yourself. And since society would protect you if you could leave it to the professionals and you didn't need to have weapons. And the theory that I've seen expressed in articles and also in law reading legal texts on this is that the more the ordinary citizen arms himself, the more excuses there for the person who intends to perpetrate something unlawful to arm himself so that he can achieve his end. So the more you arm yourself, the more the guy who wants to assault you feels he must arm himself to achieve his end. And on that theory, which leaves it, as far as I can see, to the assailant to decide the level of force to be used, they have taken this position that the ordinary people should be disarmed, but only the police should have arms. This move didn't start until the 1920s. Up until the 1920s, England had Great Britain, was very much in the same mode as America as far as allowing people. And those of you who read Sherlock Holmes know that Watson is always being asked to carry a service revolver. And there's never an issue about it. But after 1920, the Firearms Act was for the first time ordered guns to be licensed, and it came right after World War I, and that was the time at which most of the European countries imposed restrictions on firearms. They had this horrendous war, millions of men were killed, those who survived were coming back brutalized by this war, there was worry about the spread of Bolshevism and general strikes and violence at home as people got back. And the reason for that, in a sense, because the wages of people were extremely low, the conditions were bad. So the government in Britain passed this 1920 Act that you had to get a license to have a handgun. And that you had to go to your local police commissioner and prove that you were a suitable person to have a gun, and that you had a good reason to have it. And at first, the good reason included living in an isolated house where you might be worried about your safety. However, even at the beginning, a good reason was, other than in your home, was that you were a member of the government or on some public duty. So the ordinary citizens were already being kind of precluded from having firearms. But they didn't know it because these were classified documents, directives to the police. They came from the Home Office, which is in charge of the police in the whole country. So through this series of these classified documents about what constituted a good reason to have a gun, over the years, a home office ratcheted down when it was permissible. And in 1969, the final approach was that it was never permissible to have a gun for self-defense. Never a good reason. It was not a good reason to have a gun to protect valuables in a bank. So they took away people's right without there having ever been an open debate. Parliament never debated that issue of what was a good reason at all. It was just quietly done through this series of classified documents. Then in the gun issue goes on to get more and more restricted, and then long guns are still permitted, although they have to be kept in a locked safe, bolted to the floor. And the police in Britain who have no time to investigate crime do come to your house and check that your safe is bolted to the floor. They spend a lot of time being concerned about that. And other guns you have to belong to a gun club, this sort of thing. Very, very strict. Then in 1997, there was a Dunblane massacre where a guy who belonged to a gun club and had a couple of firearms went berserk and went into a primary school in this little town in Scotland and shot the teacher and a group of these little children. Now, I should say that the public was obviously appalled and outraged, and the parents of the children led a campaign to make sure that no one was allowed to have a personal handgun after that. Much attention was not directed toward the police, who had been warned several times about this guy, and no gun club wanted him. Nonetheless, he had gotten it, but had done this. During the debate over this Firearms Act, in which I should say both parties contributed, the conservatives started it, and then Labor came in and ratcheted up even stricter. There were efforts to have an amendment that would allow the Olympic target shooting team to have their firearms. And that was rejected. And so since then, they have been practicing in Switzerland and sometimes France and have apparently appealed because London is hosting the Olympics next year, I guess. Could they please practice at home? Because they used to be one of the top teams, but it's very hard if you have to travel abroad to practice and keep your weapons there. And there may be permission for them to practice on a military base. I'm not sure whether that's gone through yet. Anyway, the other amendment was to allow handicapped shooters to be able to have guns for participating in target practice, which is one of the sports that they could really compete in on an equal basis. And again, that was, there was to be zero tolerance for that. As a result of this Firearms Act, people who owned firearms had to hand them in, and there were even some, family heirlooms and so forth. They all had to be handed in to the police. They knew where they all were because they were registered. And they were crunched or otherwise destroyed, except that a few museum pieces were sent to museums. The result of this, I should say, just on the gun issue, was that within 5 years, that gun crime had doubled with handguns, the very gun that was banned and had been, confiscated from all of the people who had registered their guns. And Britain was the weapon of choice of people who wanted to violate the law. There were two other things, so I don't want to stop with guns because I know when I've given a similar talk elsewhere, people say, look, guns aren't the whole story. They really aren't. I mean, there's a slippery slope. If you don't want people to protect themselves with guns, you're not that eager they protect themselves with anything else either. Society will protect them. In 1953, there was something called the Prevention of Crime Act. You were not allowed to carry any offensive weapon in a public place. That would allow the police, I should say, to stop and search anybody that they thought might have an offensive weapon. What was an offensive weapon? Virtually anything, any item that you might use to actually protect yourself if attacked and carried it maybe for that reason, was an offensive weapon. If, of course, it could do no harm, it was not an offensive weapon. I find it hard to think of something else, something that's a purely defensive weapon, maybe a whistle, you know. But at any rate, everything else was an offensive weapon. And of course, this was done at a time when juvenile delinquents were a worry. And it also violated the traditional common law norm that a person is innocent until proven guilty. You're basically guilty of carrying something until you prove that you had a good reason to have it. And for those of you who are, I assume a lot of you lawyers, I'll just give one example of how crazy the thing is. If you were carrying a wrench with the idea that if someone attacked you, you would use it to protect yourself, that's illegal. If you're carrying a wrench because you were a plumber, that's okay. And then if somebody attacked you, you used it. If you were attacked and you happened to see a wrench on the ground and picked it up and used it, that was okay. She was never actually carried the thing with the idea of protecting yourself. During the debate in Parliament over this, there was quite a lot of upset, although the government assured people they didn't need to worry about self-defense. That was just a minor issue. One of the members of Parliament, Ronald Bell, asked, he said that he wanted to get an exemption for self-defense. He said, one has to remember there are many places where society cannot get there in time. On those occasions, a man has to defend himself and those whom he is escorting. It is not very much consolation that society will come forward a great deal later, pick up the bits, and punish the violent offender. It sounds almost exactly like John Locke. However, they were assured this was no problem. One of the members of Parliament brought up the example of a woman who worked in the Parliament and who had to cross a lonely moor at night and who had taken to carrying a knitting needle with her in her handbag. And one night she was assaulted by a young man, and it was stated that she had used the knitting needle to attack him on a sensitive part of his body and warded him off. And the Attorney General was asked, would she not be allowed to carry a knitting needle, you know, for this purpose? And was told, well, she doesn't need to do this anymore because society will take care of that and protect her. So that was the Prevention of Crime Act. There was a further one in 1967 which changed the rules on self-defense. It was a huge omnibus crime act. You have to be careful about these huge acts because things get, as we all know, popped in. And the thrust of the act, which went over a lot of areas of criminal law, changed the distinction between a felony and a misdemeanor, sort of abolished the distinction. It also decided that when it came to self-defense, that you didn't have to retreat, but only use force that was deemed reasonable in the circumstances. It sounded like a real positive move. You know, you don't have to retreat, just use what seems reasonable force to prevent a crime or assist in the arrest of offenders. However, the problem is that what's reasonable is a very slippery standard. It is judged much, much later in the court of law by people who are not on the scene and are a lot of time, you know, sitting in comfortable circumstances. So the reasonable standard has really reduced the scope for self-defense. Glanville Williams, who wrote a textbook on criminal law that's kind of classic, argued that the requirement that an individual's efforts to defend himself be reasonable was, quote, now stated in such mitigated terms as to cast doubt on whether it still forms part of the law. It was just extraordinarily difficult. It's never reasonable, according to them, to use extreme force to protect property, which meant that if someone broke into your house and you didn't know what their plans were, you know, you have to assume that all they're there for is to take your property, you're not allowed to do anything to them much. Apparently you can, however, give the robber blows and threaten him with a weapon, but you must not harm him, because if you harmed him, I mean, if you did real damage to the intruder, then you would be charged with assault, or if you killed him, with murder. And then there were actual occasions when intruders sat down with a person person who was home and said, you know, you do anything to me and then you're going to be in trouble. The Labor Party eventually, after a lot of public protests, did modify that so that you still can, that you have somewhat more scope. And robbers can no longer sue if they get harmed while breaking into your house. I mean, if breaking in, they cut themselves on the glass or something like that, they used to be able to sue you, but now they can no longer do that. In addition to guns and not being able to carry a offensive weapon, there are also a list of prohibited weapons. This is a whole separate list. And it includes things like rocket launchers and machine guns. It also includes pepper spray, a knife with a blade more than 3 inches long. And all of these devices will earn you a 10-year sentence. So for carrying pepper spray, you get the same 10 years as someone who had a rocket launcher carried down the street. A young couple recently used pepper spray, or at least owned it without realizing this. I'm not sure what became of them, but I mean, the penalty was, you know, a 10-year sentence. So there's really a kind of zero tolerance of the public having anything or using anything much to protect themselves. Now, all of this I can give you some more examples. I don't want to take all the time because I know we're okay. Okay, I'll give you some examples of how some of these laws worked. There's one that this was an early one after the law that didn't permit you to carry an offensive weapon. It involves an executive from British Petroleum who was traveling on the underground in London, 56 years old. His name, Eric Butler. And in March of 1987, two men assaulted him in the subway car, strangling him and smashing his head against the door. No one came to his aid. No one is supposed to come to your aid. People are to walk on by or to call the police. So no one came to his aid. They were smashing his head against the door. He later testified, quote, my air supply was being cut off. My eyes became blurred. I feared for my life. In desperation, he unsheathed the sword blade in his walking stick. You know, one of these ones that you get at notion stores. And he said, as a last means of defense, and he stabbed a man in the stomach, one of his assailants. The assailants were charged with unlawful wounding. Butler was also tried and convicted of carrying an offensive weapon. And since the authorities have never thought about these sword sticks in their list of forbidden devices, they added sword sticks to the list of prohibited devices. Had that been the case when he was attacked, he would not have had the sword stick.
Where did that happen?
On the subway car in London.
Okay, and you said the passersby who saw this were not supposed to come to his aid.
People in the car.
Of course, in this country, there's no duty for somebody to come to their aid unless they cause the problem. Do you mean in London, if you see that happening, you are not supposed to?
You're supposed to leave it. You're supposed to call the professionals, and they will handle it. It used to be, the common law actually used to insist that you intervene, and it was a crime if you didn't. It was called misprision of treason. If you saw a crime being committed, you had an obligation to intervene to help the person who was, you know, being attacked or to stop the crime. And they've gone so far as to decide that not only are you not to intervene, but you know, you should just call a professional. And at one point, BBC, and its wisdom, put up a list online of what you should do if attacked in the street. Thought it was kind of interesting what to do. I mean, you could carry keys, you could use keys to protect yourself, or a handbag or a briefcase. But if attacked, you were to shout, call the police. And I thought about this, and I thought, normally if you're attacked, call help, you know, help. But presumably no one was to help. You were just to call the police. Of course, by the time the police got there, you know, the whole thing would be over. Also, if you knocked the person down who was attacking you, then you were to run away, because if you persisted in hitting him, outrage, then you are charged with assault. So if you're, you know, the scope for people in their own homes or out of their own homes is so narrow. people are afraid to go out. London, if any of you have been there, has, I think, the most surveillance cameras of probably any city in the world. It's nice that, you know, that they're watching everybody. Of course, all it takes is a hood, you know, or a mask, and they can't tell who's doing anything. But that was, the idea was to leave it. I mean, it's modified, it's beginning to, maybe because Jack Straw, who was at the Home Office under the last Labor government, had personally been involved in chasing voters. And only when he had personally been involved three times did he decide that maybe we should change the rules on this and allow someone to intervene. But that was because of his own personal experience. Before that, it was decided that he would just make a mess of it. Police really don't like, even in this country, don't like people to intervene because they might get it wrong. They, you know. One other case, and this one you probably, some of you probably know about, is the Tony Martin case. And this one is an interesting example because it combines so many of the notions that the English have, the British, I should say, but it's more mostly the English, about the way that the law ought to work. There's been a lot of concern about the treatment of offenders. No one under 18 is incarcerated except under very, very extraordinary circumstances. So anybody under 18 who commits a crime is given, you know, a warning and goes back on the street. They've reduced the number of sentences because they feel that prison doesn't really rehabilitate. And anyway, it's expensive to keep people in prison. And a couple of years ago, the commissioner of prisons said that even though the prisons were overcrowded, he wasn't going to build any more unless the prisons could show a better rate of rehabilitation. Presumably, they never will. I mean, they never seem to feel that getting people off the street is a plus in itself. It's a notion that, you know, that this is really sad and something needs to be done. There was even an effort to try to make sure that people leaving prison were given subsidized housing so that they wouldn't have a hard time getting someplace to live. Anyway, Tony Martin was a 50-year-old farmer living in a very rural area in a house that was so poor that when the police came, they thought it was a shed. There's this little kind of rundown old house and presumably a barn and a few apple trees, right? Yet his man had been robbed six times. The repeated burglaries over and over and over. On the seventh occasion, Martin was determined to not happen. I don't know what the man could have left. There were two burglars who came. They had driven 40 miles to come to his poor house. I should say too that the other six times, you know, he had called the police, but nothing had been done. And something like three quarters of British rural communities have no police presence. It makes sense to consolidate police departments. So if you're thinking economically, you know, you don't need a policeman in every town. So there's nobody really that's, you know, very close by. At any rate, at about 10 at night, it's dark, he hears breaking glass and some voices downstairs as these guys go through his what's left of his silverware, presumably. And he crept downstairs in the dark with a shotgun, and he just shot twice. And apparently he wounded one of these fellows who was a career burglar, I guess about 40, and had led a gang of burglars for some time. And he killed his younger apprentice, who was 16, and who managed to get out of the place and then die after. Martin didn't know that till the next day. It was dark, and he just left. The police came and arrested him for murder, attempted murder, and having an unregistered shotgun. For attempted murder, it was, you know, a long prison term. At the trial, the family and friends of the younger burglar sat in the court watching the jury, who later said that they felt so upset by it that they actually appealed to the government, which is a first, that they were worried because these guys knew who they were. And they, but at any rate, the prosecutor claimed that Martin had had caught them like rats in a trap. I love that. His house was somehow the trap. He was just waiting for somebody to come in to drive 40 miles and come into the house in the middle of the night. But at any rate, this persuaded the jury, who were sitting there worried and who were given very little option, I guess, in the way that the British law works. So he was convicted of murder, attempted murder, and having some registered felon, and sent out for a long time. The career burglar was given 3 years for robbery. Later on, Martin appealed. There was a huge public outcry about this. And so they listened to his appeal, and on the premise that he had been abused as a child, his sentence was reduced to 5 years. The career burglar applied for parole and was paroled after serving 18 months. Martin applied for parole, and his parole appeal was rejected because, quote, he posed a threat to burglars. He had expressed no remorse. And this came from the law commission, so I don't know who the people are in that commission. But anyway, he was a threat to burglars, and so he had to serve his full time. The burglar who got out early, his name was Brian Farron, then sued Martin for the injury to his leg, which he claimed was interfering with his sex life and with his judo training, which he liked, and also his job. And since the only job anyone knew he had ever had was robbery, that seemed like maybe that would be a good thing. At any rate, he sues Martin. All Martin has is this little old house and a few acres, you know, and is in jail with almost no money. The government gave him $7,500 to bring the lawsuit. I mean, that's why I wanted to bring this example, because there's so many aspects of it that are so appalling to an American. I mean, maybe I just don't understand the way of thinking. But at any rate, during the law, while he was suing, somebody noticed that he actually took a film of him galloping up a flight of stairs. So it was clear that the injury had not done him any great harm. And so he lost his suit. And about a year or so later, he was back in jail for drug offense. The police claimed that they could not guarantee Martin's safety, but they let him out, you know, when his time was up. So that was one man's horrendous story. A more recent one, slightly different, involved a former soldier, Paul Clark. In 2009, he was looking out his back window, and his backyard backed on a kind of vacant lot, and he saw this big black plastic bag in the back of the yard. So he went to investigate, and inside was a gun, rifle. So he took it into the house, and he called the police and brought it to them. And being a former soldier, he's very careful, you know, to place it so that the barrel's pointing toward the wall, away from the police. They all looked at it and immediately took him below to the cells and charged him with having an unregistered gun, and he was just charged with to be sentenced for 5 years. It's a 5-year penalty for having an unregistered gun. Now, he apparently, unbeknownst to Mr. Clark, the law that they had passed in Surrey was that if you saw a gun, you were not to touch it. You were to call the police. They would come and get it. Because he caught, you know, picked it up and brought it to them, he was violating the law. And at his trial, the judge said that there was actually nothing that could be done. Here's the judge's comment. He said, in law, there is no dispute that Mr. Clark has no defense to this charge. The intention of anybody possessing a firearm is irrelevant. And then the same county of Surrey, which I think has a lot to answer for, when I was working on articles about the recent riots, I discovered that the police in Surrey were not allowing people to put wire mesh on the windows of their garden sheds because an intruder might get hurt on the wire mesh. So you were basically to make it as easy as possible for these people to get in without being hurt. The really sad thing about all of this is, first, that they've disarmed people and on the premise society will protect them, but society is not protecting. I mean, because of economic reasons and sort of sympathy for offenders, there's a real reluctance to be very vigorous about it. The latest crinkle for the police that's saving money and police time is giving out something they call a caution. If you get a caution, you can get a caution for being it being the first time that you have been picked up for a particular crime. You may have had 20 burglaries. They finally get you. It's the first time that they've had you. You can be released with a caution. It means that you may have a record, but that you do not serve any time, you do not have a trial, you do not even have community service, nothing. You just get turned back onto the street. So this is, you know, very much a time saver for the police. Cautions became very popular. There are now 60 crimes for which offenders can get a caution. And these include assault and arson. They originally also included sex with a minor, but that seems to have been taken off the books. So 60 crimes for which the police can give you a caution. As I say, no jail time, no fine, no community service, no court appearance. In 2009, 4 in 10 serious criminals in Britain were let off with a caution. That same year, 70% of the burglars who they actually managed to catch were let off with a caution. 40% of crimes were not investigated at all. No time. They had all the time in the world to come and check on the gun being in a safe, bolted to the floor, but absolutely no time to follow up, you know, ordinary crimes. There was one, you know, the counties even, you know, announced that they're simply not going to be able to handle it, and only a couple of things they'll follow up on. The results of all of this on public order are, you know, the serious cost. Mugging in London now is 6 to 7 times more likely. You're more likely to get mugged in London than in Harlem. Not just in New York, but in Harlem. Gun crime has sort of doubled in the last decade. In 2009, Britain was the most dangerous country in Europe. The people of England and Wales have a 23% risk of becoming crime victim. Then we have the August riots, which I happened to be in Britain, fortunately Scotland, while all this was happening, stranded for 3 days in the Glasgow airport. But it was useful in the sense that I got the latest news. So these riots broke out. There had been protests earlier, maybe a couple weeks earlier, about police shooting a guy who, I think he had, they claimed he had shot first and then they shot. But anyway, there was some protests. But then there was nothing. And these people who were rioting were not protesting anything. In fact, somebody said that riot seemed the wrong word. I mean, it was basically just a free-for-all, really horrendous, with people being killed, bludgeoned to death. In some cases, in front of the police, there was one case in which a policeman stood and watched somebody being beaten up and called for backup. And I thought afterwards that no American policeman would have stood there. He would have taken out his gun. He would have stopped things. But instead, this lone policeman called for backup, by which time, presumably, the person being beaten up was ready to go to the hospital. Several people were killed. There were stores and cars and buildings burnt, people running out of the top floors of buildings with their children. Arsonists set fire to the whole thing. It went on for 3 days. It spread to other cities. The police, there's some films of what went on, but the police really handled it badly. They are not very much geared toward, I think, protecting the public. There's one place, I think it was in Croydon, where there was a riot going on at one end of the street. And people were being ripped off bicycles and cars that went through and beaten up, and buildings were set alight. The police were all down at the end of the street in a line, not doing anything except protecting the center of the town that the rioters would have to get through them to get to. So whatever was happening at one end of the street, they were not interfering. They were just making sure that the thing spread. I suppose that's one way of looking at what goes on, you know, keeping it contained. It's just that they also didn't do anything to help anybody who was in there. There was a lot of self-defense, you know, to the extent people could manage it. There was one restaurant where a group of thugs broke in and
a kind of upscale restaurant, which is described as, you know, trying to rob all of the patrons of the restaurant. And the owner and the wait staff and the cook came out brandishing knives and drove these guys out, which I thought was wonderful, you know. They were well equipped to take care of it and were brave enough to do it. But the aftermath is quite interesting because while I was there and while these were going on, of course, the talking heads on the BBC and television were saying, well, you know, what can you expect? There's poverty, there's inequality. Some of these people are unemployed. They didn't do well on their A levels, which are the high school exams. Actually, use that. Oh, I disappointed A levels. And of course, the things that were being robbed, no one was getting food. Nobody was breaking into a bookstore. It was all high-tech computer equipment, expensive sneakers, stuff like that was flowing off the shelves. It wasn't people who were starving, because Britain has a very generous social safety net. When they came to the rioters afterwards, I thought it was interesting to see what what I think is kind of a lax attitude toward criminality had produced. Were these people just people who were upset by their A-levels? Were they people who had had experience with police before? There were 75% of the rioters had a previous conviction or caution, 75%. So these were guys who had, you know, been just put right back out on the street. And I pity anybody who goes to court as a witness against anybody who's going to be out on the street the next day. You know, who would want to do that? Who would want to testify if somebody's going to be back? Anyway, 75% had a previous conviction, 25% had 10 previous convictions, and those with a criminal record averaged 15 offenses. And there's no three strikes and you're out there. I mean, there's 15 offenses. Why are they out there? But the thing is that if you take the attitude that punishment isn't going to do any good, and you don't allow any deterrence, then it really isn't surprising. I mean, it simply wasn't surprising that happened. And what was surprising, I guess, is that it doesn't happen more. So the key, as far as I'm concerned, to wrap up, is that self-defense really is primary. I think it reduces crime, it prevents it, it acts as a deterrent, it permits people to actually protect their own personal right, their most primary law of nature, for themselves, for their family. It's perfectly natural. And Blackstone was wrong that no government could take it away, because a government, his own government, now has. And I'd just like to end with one comment about from an English judge some time ago. He said, it is implicit in a genuine right that its exercise may work against some facet of the public interest. A right to speak only where its exercise advanced the public welfare or public policy would be a hollow guarantee against repression. I mean, there's some misuse of guns, but the right to have it is so much more fundamental. And all rights have some downside. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about all of this. Yes?
What is the likelihood that those riots are game changer for the way Britons view self-defense law?
I had hoped that they would be, and the conservative government was wanting that. You know, Cameron was very keen to see that the courts really started to enforce the law more vigorously, and in some cases they have, although there were protests about it. But even though it seemed like that was going to happen, the prevailing culture has kind of pushed back. And so recently, the Guardian newspaper, along with the economics department, I think the London School of Economics, did a big study of interviewing the rioters. They interviewed hundreds of rioters about why they were rioting. And I have to say that it seemed to me that their results were kind of loaded by including an economics department. But at any rate, we discovered that the rioters did not like the police. And so maybe the police need to be a little kinder. And apparently the Guardian had a big 4-page spread on the results of this. And the
BBC carried it. So, you know, again, there's sort of, well, this notion that, you know, there's inequality, you can't expect people to behave any better. You know, The Guardian even claimed in reviewing some of the court cases that someone had been brought to court for stealing 2 scoops of ice cream. I mean, forgetting, mind you, the people who were beaten to pulp and killed, or the people whose lives were at risk because their buildings burned, or shopkeepers whose whole inventory or livelihood was spoiled, but someone was arrested, according to The Guardian, for taking 2 scoops of ice cream. So I think that there is a real cultural group whose only sympathy is with the downtrodden, and they consider anybody who, you know, doesn't have a job, maybe these people don't want one or don't, to be deprived, and therefore what can one expect? So I wish that something would happen, but it's hard to shift that paradigm. Yeah.
Concerning the origins of the Firearms Act of 1920, the one that first licensed pistols and rifles in Britain, there's a paper that by Joe Olson and myself was published, I think it was in Maine Law Review, called Politics, Trump's Crime Control.
Oh, great.
Which goes into great detail with all of the cabinet papers were declassified in 1969, 1970, and demonstrates that they even say directly in the cabinet minutes, and we're going to have to pretend this is a crime control measure. And then they actually state in the cabinet meeting, you know, this is because we're afraid of Bolshevik revolution in this country. So you might find it quite entertaining because, you know, they clearly lied in Parliament why they were trying to pass this law. So to give you some idea how certainly restrictive it has become, I have a friend who was a reserve police officer in Britain, and he was regularly issued a Browning high power for his work. His work involved interdiction of weapons smuggling via the IRA through British airports. And even though he's regularly issued a handgun when he's out on duty, he indicated that his understanding was he would not have been able to obtain a license to have a pistol or rifle in his own home. They don't even really trust their own cops when they're off duty, which is quite insane. Concerning this decline in crime rates that we've experienced in the United States, really quite an impressive decline. Bernard Harcourt has published a couple of papers doing a multivariate correlation analysis, trying to analyze all the different factors that explain this decline. It's interesting, Harcourt is actually, as near as I can tell, supportive of gun control, but he did not include gun control as one of the, gun ownership as one of the items that he used in his multivariate correlation analysis, which tells me that he might support gun control, but he apparently doesn't really believe that it plays any part in it. So those papers are well worth reading because they examine all the differing explanations for why we did not have the increase in crime rates in the late 1990s that a lot of criminologists had expected the super predators that were supposedly being created to create. What you mentioned about Hamilton and the gun club, the interesting thing is Hamilton was, from what I have read, not even close to being qualified for the pistol license that he had. There is some speculation, unfortunately, all of the detailed information about the commission came out with was locked up for 100 years.
Oh, no, really?
Supposedly to protect the privacy of the children that Hamilton apparently had been molesting for some time. The police knew that he was a pedophile. There have been repeated complaints about his unnatural interest in children, and yet they continue to renew his pistol license. Now remember, they don't have to issue a pistol license, they don't have to renew one at that time, and yet they're continuing to renew one. There were apparently some close relationships between Hamilton and a number of the police officials in that area of Scotland, and the question has been, you know, what was the nature of these relationships, and why were they continuing to renew a permit for someone who was clearly not legally qualified? You had mentioned the effort to reduce the use of prison for offenses. ACLU of Southern California has a suit underway right now. They are challenging the current California law, which makes robbery into a felony. And their argument is that robbery should not be an imprisonable offense. You understand, to me, this is just really quite bizarre. They're actually making a constitutional challenge to the idea of robbery as a felony.
So we have the right to keep and bear arms, and we have the right to commit robbery.
I always find myself fascinated by the issue of Southern California. Their notions are quite unique.
Happily.
Yeah. It also mentioned about that person in Surrey who was sent to jail for possession. Those of you that saw the article in America's First Freedom a few months back about the Sullivan Law that I wrote, one of the examples I found was a woman who in Brooklyn who found a handgun lying in the gutter. She picked it up and took it to the police, and she was convicted and imprisoned for a Sullivan Law violation.
So we do the same thing.
Yes. But then again, the Sullivan Law, those who read the article know that the guy that the law is named for, was actually a gangster. He was the president of the Brothel Owners Association in New York City.
Yeah.
Even though brothels were illegal at that point.
Excuse me.
He was a gangster. And it was pretty clear that during much of this period, at least part of the reason for the Sullivan Law was there were organized crime figures who were actually getting carry permits under the Sullivan Law, people that were known to be criminals, because they had the political connections to get permits issued. Quite an astonishing example of the insanity of New York City.
Other questions?
A comment. You spoke police saying they're always ready to protect and we need to, and you cited the D.C. case. Of course, there was the much more recent case out of Oklahoma, which I assume everybody is familiar with. It's not a legal case. It's a news story case. Is there anybody not familiar with the Oklahoma case? The 18-year-old, recently widowed young mother, her husband died on Christmas Day of cancer, and she had to sell most of his gun collection to pay for the funeral. She had a 3-month-old baby, and about 10 days after her husband died, two people attempted to break into her, it was probably a trailer house. She barricaded the front door with a couch. She called 911 and was on the phone for 21 minutes. She retreated to a back bedroom, locked the door as best possible, of course had her baby with her. She pulled up the two guns that she had not sold of her husband, a 12-gauge shotgun and a handgun, and she's still on the phone with a police dispatcher. She puts a baby bottle in her baby's mouth and holds a shotgun, and she's asking the dispatcher, she said, "I think they're in the house. If they come through this door, can I shoot?" And the dispatcher, a woman, said, "I cannot tell you that you can shoot them, but I can tell you, do what you have to protect your baby." And so she shot. She is a fantastic, the gunnies ought to be all over her. It is just a miraculous story. I was in contact with Bob Cottrell, who just walked in after this story happened, and I said, as a former reporter, I know what the liberal media is going to do with this. If this story gets legs, they are going to go all over it, and the next thing you're going to know, you're going to see headlines that she was pregnant by 2 months when she got married. But it's 21 minutes she's on the phone asking for help. 21 minutes. And the only thing she had left to protect herself with is her husband's 12-gauge shotgun, which was one of the two guns of her husband's she did not sell to pay for his funeral.
Well, one point about that story, the man who broke in, as I recall, had a very large knife.
Yes.
He was stalking her in the days leading up to the break-in. At least that's
okay. What I had heard, and I don't know that anybody knows now, the man who came in first is dead, of course. What I had read was there was the thought that because her husband died of cancer and that information was out in the community, that perhaps these people who broke in may have assumed that he had Oxycontin or some very heavy painkiller because he was terminal cancer. So perhaps they were breaking for that.
Just a property crime.
Yes.
Professor, I have just two quick questions, if you wouldn't mind. One was, you mentioned a statistic that 75% of the rioters, I wasn't sure if it's in London or in Britain,
In Britain, right.
In Britain in general.
But most of the rioting was in London.
Right. Had previous criminal histories.
Right.
I was wondering how they could determine that, given that
Well, if you've got a caution, it goes on your record, but you're not punished.
Right, but I'm saying how, there were thousands of
they arrested quite a lot of people afterwards.
So the ones that went to trial. It was of the number who were arrested.
Right.
And then the second question.
Because presumably some people might have gotten arrested.
Right. And the other question was, I wasn't sure of the connection between your presentation and gun ownership, in that it seemed to me like a lot of the issues that you were identifying, a lot of the anecdotes that you gave, the reason for a lot of, I would assume, the widespread outrage in the room, had a lot more to do with police responses, laws having to do with liability, and things that had seemed more cultural deficiencies than gun laws per se. So I wasn't, were you trying to make a connection between all of that and gun laws, or were you just saying there are fundamental
I think that the attitude toward self-defense is the connection. In other words, that you take away people's right to be armed with guns, to be armed with a walking stick, to be armed with fight back, to exercise their right to self-defense. Sometimes they call self-defense vigilantism. You're taking the law in your own hands. So I think the connection is that that guns are a part of it. They're not the whole story. It's larger. So you give up the guns, and then they'll go after the next thing. I mean, you know, you're not. There are a whole series of approaches to basically disarming the public and not allowing people to protect themselves. Is that?
Okay.
I'm not sure I answered.
No, I think you did. So it seemed like your argument then is that gun control would only be the first step because of the general cultural assumptions behind it. It would just creep forward.
Yes, I think it's the general assumption is that society protects you. You don't need to do anything.
Okay.
Yes, in fact.
Sure, I mentioned this.
Should Americans consider boycotting the United Kingdom? I'm serious. Until it's lost, Jason.
I don't know that that will have any impact. They still insist that we're a cowboy country now.
Okay,
but
basically you describe it as a surveillance society
right. That
is not just neglectful of, but actively hostile to traditional rights of personal integrity and property. At some, that sounds like a predatory government at some level. Does there come a point where one is where there are principled issues? Spending your tourism dollars there. I was last in England, 11 years ago, so this is fairly academically at this point. But I wonder about questions like this when I hear accounts like the ones that you provided, Professor.
Well, it really is much more dangerous than I think most people realize. Britain was always considered such a safe place compared to America.
I remember there was a hubbub when their violent crime rates passed ours.
Yes.
About 2004, there was
So they don't believe it. They, and there are slightly different ways of calculating types of crime. And then they always come back and say, yes, but you have more murders, which is, to go to the cultural point. We always have had, but also they sort of jigger their murder statistics to make them as low as possible. And we have, the FBI insists that every suspicious death be called a murder, a homicide. So our statistics are as high as possible, theirs are as low as possible. So but we do have more murders. So they try to end the conversation with that. And it is true that we do have more. But we have a very different kind of society, too. Yes, the next two.
About the responsibility of government to protect people. The New York Court of Appeals, the High Court, in the last month or so handed down a decision that was like the recent DeShaney cases. Except in this case, the police actually said something like, we'll be right over, or we'll apprehend him immediately, some woman's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend or something. In fact, they didn't, and he beat her up, but despite this statement that we'll act now, no liability, no responsibility for the police.
No, it's sort of shocking, particularly when it's always used as an example of why people don't need to protect themselves. But there's a sort of joke in Britain that, you know, if you want the police to come right away, you know, when they're intruders, just say that I've just killed an intruder and I'll be there on the spot. You're just threatened. You're right. I just shot an intruder before you dig around. They'll be. Yeah.
The Offenses Against Persons Act of 1861 that Britain passes, in some respects, I think that may be one of the things that people might want to look into as an explanation for the development of the changing attitude about firearms. The Offenses Act of that year does significantly restrict the ability to use deadly force. And I wonder if that may have discouraged Britons who traditionally had owned firearms for self-defense. It discouraged a lot of them from doing so, and thus made it easier to get the Firearms Act in 1920 passed.
What this was 1861.
The Offenses Against Persons Act limits use of deadly force so that it has to be proportionate response, meaning that you could not use a gun against someone who merely had a knife. You could only use a gun against someone who also had a gun. And the effect of this was to significantly limit people's willingness to use deadly force. It would be very interesting to look into why Parliament went ahead and passed that act at the time that they did. If anyone wants to pursue that as a perhaps a good law review article.
Yeah, although it was still very hard to get those for the first gun restriction passed. The government tried earlier in the 20th century on 1903. And Parliament utterly rejected it. There was what they called little toy guns, you know, very small kind of inaccurate guns that were being purchased. And they claimed that, you know, those were a hazard and that several people had been shot. And the members of Parliament said that this was being, you know, they didn't want to become a nanny state or a super nanny state. And that everybody should be punished because a few careless kids got shot. And they basically, you know, laughed it out of Parliament. So they hung out for a long time, and I think it was just mainly World War I that caused that difference. You know, allowed the government. And that, of course, these papers are still secret. It's very hard. I couldn't get at some of the papers. I wanted to find out their explanation for their ratcheting down the reason for having a gun. You know, some smoking gun by the bureaucrats, but all of the papers are sealed for years and years and years, so it's hard to get. I can get things about the 1920 Act, but beyond that, it's hard. Any other questions? Oh, yes.
There's certainly a sense of outrage on the room about see problems with Britain's approach towards self-defense, but did you find any support for your position among British academics?
Probably less among British academics than among the British people as a whole. Some years ago, the Telegraph, one of their major papers, had a campaign to try to sort of give homeowners more discretion about self-defense and being under control, you know, protect themselves. And Radio 4, one of the radio stations, had a competition. One of the members of Parliament agreed that he would submit to Parliament whatever bill a majority of people wanted, you know, that most people voted for. And the one that came in first was to permit homeowners to take vigorous action against intruders. And he was appalled. He called it this bloodstained piece of legislation. Did not want to introduce it. The one that he preferred was what came in second, and that was that you were, that when you died, that your organs were to be donated unless you had ahead of time opted out of this. He liked that one, but he did not like the idea that people. So there's a tremendous amount of public support, but when the Conservative government coming in this time tried to make a change and they've been kind of snowed under with other things, but they introduced a change saying that you could use defense that was not grossly disproportionate in your own home. the liberal media leapt all over it, claiming this was going back to medieval lynch law. So it's hard to, you know, I think there's a lot of popular support, but it's hard to get the establishment on board.
Oh, just one last question.
Yeah.
If statutorily, you know, the wordings used were to be, you know, somehow changed miraculously through the political process, what do you think are the is the likelihood that that would make much of a difference when it came to applying these new terms to factual cases on ground? Do you think that judges, I don't know how you might assess this, I'm just asking for your cultural.
No, I think that they, you know, the judges will have to go along if the actual language of the law, you know, standards for self-defense change. And there's a lot of public support for people who do protect themselves. I mean, there was another case recently where a man who owned a florist shop was playing dominoes and, you know, when the place was closed and three gun-toting intruders burst in. And it, believe it or not, in the scuffle that followed, this older owner of the florist shop got a knife and actually damaged and, you know, killed the guy who came in with a gun. The police, the headline said, police nicked 72-year-old shopkeeper. They arrested him and only later let him out because of, you know, it was clearly self-defense. I think that there's a lot, I think they feel worried about the public opinion, and I think that it will change, and it would be nice if the riots leave them with the impression that something needs to be done. You can't have police who just don't want to be bothered, you know, prosecuting cases and sentences that are so short that they're kind of meaningless. So I think that, but the judges have a very, you know, exalted kind of life, that they're not necessarily in there with it. Out on the streets, as it were. Well, we hope they obey the law.
You kept referring to the idea that the government has an exclusive right to force.
That's their notion, yeah.
Well, I think that, but the majority of people don't feel that way as fundamental human rights, you know, natural right. I think with reference to our own country, is there a risk of falling into that trap when we aren't very good, I guess, as a society, at discussing the role of policing and the role of government work versus individual rights and how they relate?
Well, there are a lot of people that believe that the police can handle everything now or don't. There are a lot of people that won't touch a gun or feel that they, you know, if something happens that they should just call 911 and that's it. Or there's an awful lot of private security in this country. All those gated communities, you know. I mean, Americans, even those who feel that they're, even those who might be anti-gun, it might be ensconced in a gated community. I think there's a real split, but I think the majority of people in the country are in favor of being able to protect themselves, and that's why the states are moving.
There might be an interesting law review article here on self-defense. As I recall, Blackstone treated it as objective. Is the use of force necessary to preserve your life, etc.?
Right, self-preservation.
The American common law, as I recall, in the early 19th century shifted that to, did you reasonably believe that it was necessary? A subjective standard. And my question is, how does Heller affect that? Because Heller talks of the constitutional right to self-defense as the most fundamental of all rights. Does that mean that there could be a constitutional right to act when it's objectively necessary, even if you don't subjectively have a reasonable belief? This is a situation often encountered by law enforcement and sometimes by private persons. We had one in the case in Arizona where the guy used lethal force against someone who was attacking him. In fact, if you knew all the guy's background, including the mental history of the attacker, you would conclude that it probably was necessary to save his life. But because he didn't know those things, it couldn't afford a reasonable basis for a belief, and that evidence was excluded until the Court of Appeals found some way around it. That might be a decent article.
I hope somebody's keeping track of these ideas. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Malcolm, and I thank Dave, but Dave's going to be up a dozen times, and I apologize by calling some people by their first names, because most of these people I've known most of my life, and so I sometimes will fail and call them by their first name.